This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast.
Welcome to Making Conversation. You're with myself and a squawking cockatoo.
Rogue bird.
I think I might start by getting you to introduce yourself. Someone came up to you at networking functions and said, and not one of the specific networking functions where you know everyone. It's one of those ones.
Oh, that never happens anyway.
That's fantastic. Where, for example, you've got people there from all different art forms and things like that. How would you describe yourself?
Okay, what a hard-hitting question, straight up. How would I describe myself? Well, first of all, I would say that my name was Holly. And then I would obviously introduce myself as a composer. And I'd probably also say that I'm a performer as well, in the sense that I play drums, I play trumpet, and I play flute. And then I'll probably give some kind of spiel about how my rock influences influence the kind of compositions that I make. And then I'll probably stop there for fear of revealing too much.
I actually wanted to ask you more about, you were saying before, about playing, because I actually, and I'll come back to this a few times, I listened to an interview you had with... Your eyes just popped out, Polly. She's like, what do we know? What do we know that I don't know?
That's that trigger word, interview.
The interview. Well, this is an interview, so just hang on to your hat. You don't have one, but that's okay, metaphorically. So you had an interview with one of the staples of Australian music, Richard Gill. And that was for 2MBS, I believe? Or it was broadcast.
I think so. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, it was for, I think it was for Limelight.
It was, yeah.
A lot of people talked about when they started in music, their inspiration and their influence being classical. So I started on piano, I started on violin, my mum encouraged me, my dad encouraged me. How did you actually start?
Oh, well, I guess there's a little bit of a story, which maybe you're already familiar with.
And but it's this one. But for the listeners at home.
For the benefit of the tape, I should say that, okay, so I guess my inspiration was my older brother, Nathan, who he started playing euphonium or baritone, I think it was euphonium, in the school band in year one. And he started playing because the band teacher needed a serious, responsible boy to take up a larger instrument. So, of course, Nathan's name came up. And so from that, he played for about a year in the band, and I would always say to my parents that, oh, I don't want to be in the band, please, you can't make me be in the band, which my parents found very strange because it never actually pushed or encouraged me to be in the band at all. And then when I was in kindergarten, I just started at school, and my brother came home for some unknown reason with two euphoniums, or a euphonium and a baritone, and I remember thinking, oh, okay, I kind of like to have a go at that. And so I had a bit of a blow at this euphonium, and I was like, oh man, awesome. And then from that moment forward, I wanted to be in the band. And then there were only two instruments available at the school at that time, and they were trumpet and flute. And I think I probably had my heart set on playing the flute, but it turned out that that actually wasn't an option. They just gave that instrument away. So I had to play trumpet, which is great because I loved playing trumpet. And it was only later when I started at uni that I started playing flute. I feel like it kind of came full circle.
It came full circle. You're like, the flute. We came back to the flute eventually. Do you still play the trumpet?
I do still play, although I probably don't practice as much as I should, especially the last couple of years. But up until a couple of years ago, I was playing pretty regularly and in different sort of experimental rock bands around Sydney, that kind of thing.
Where did you actually go to high school?
Oh, I went to St. Paul's Grammar.
Yep.
In Cranbrook.
Cranbrook. So where is that in the general sense of Sydney for someone who's from Queensland?
Yeah, sure. It's about 5 to 10 minutes north of Penrith.
Okay.
So still Western Sydney.
Still Western Sydney.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to move on to. Western Sydney has often gotten, and I think unfairly so, this bad rap.
Oh, yeah. 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 I hear you.
Yeah, I really, and I just wanted to know, how would you comment on something like that? Because we do as well get it in Brisbane. In the previous interview, you talked about Western Sydney Uni and how there seemed to be a divide in the communities of the Western Sydney Uni composers and those at the Con. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know if you could comment on that and how you navigated that.
Well, I think it's hard for me to comment on the Western Sydney thing because my entire life I've lived in Western Sydney. And so I guess what I mean is from being within, kind of looking out, I don't really understand how other people perceive Western Sydney, but it wasn't really until I started going to uni as an undergrad that I was kind of met with this idea that when I said that I was studying in Western Sydney, that it was kind of met with a little bit of stigma. And still to this day, I don't really understand why that is. But I do know that, and probably also what you heard me talk about in that interview, is that what I've enjoyed about going overseas and working with different ensembles and different players is that all of a sudden what institute or what area of the world or what part of Sydney you came from immediately becomes invisible.
You actually have, from what I saw on your website, which mm-hmm. I have to compliment you on because it's very well laid out, you have all your opportunities on the side, and one week you've got, oh, we have a premiere here at, or a premiere or my work's being played at Riverside Theatres mm-hmm. in Parramatta.
Yep, that was last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, with Sydney Symphony Fellows, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Jabberwock. But you also had something as well that was premiered in Parramatta recently, I thought.
Michael, recently,
Kieran Harvey and Timothy Phillips?
Yeah. Yes, that was at Kingswood Campus though. Yes. For the WSU's Creativity Unlimited Festival. Yes.
You seem to find yourself opportunities. How do you do that?
Ooh, what a question. Look, to be honest, I was going to say I don't know, but that's not really true. I think that the first opportunity that I had really was when I had a work performed in Taiwan as part of when I was a young composer that was representing Australia for the Asian Composers League. And that came about because my mentor at the time at WSU, Bruce Crossman, encouraged me to enter into that. So I should say that some of the opportunities that I've been fortunate enough to receive have been a result of entering something or sending off a score or answering some kind of call for scores, things like that.
Michael Kieran Harvey has been quoted as saying, competitions are an unnecessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that statement? Especially for composers, because I've noticed when I've looked at submissions for work, there are a lot of competitions that are mm-hmm. listed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, well, first of all, I think it's really important not to take a competition too seriously. That you have to bear in mind that obviously whatever kind of institution or body is opening up a call for scores or a competition are looking for, well, usually looking for a specific kind of thing. So I do try not to take it too seriously. But I should say that what I have entered in, especially earlier on, I haven't really entered in anything the last 18 months or so, I've tried to be careful and choose particular things that I already had something ready for or that I could tweak or that I didn't already have to put in, which sounds bad, but a huge amount of effort in order to maybe reap some kind of benefit from.
How did you go about beginning to compose?
Oh, well, okay. Well, I guess the answer is simple. I mean, the reason that I started to compose in the first place was, well, first of all, I needed to for assignments. Okay, so in years 11 and 12, I did the International Baccalaureate instead of a high school certificate. So, and because I did music for that, I did what they call, you can either choose between standard level or high level. So I chose high level music. There was one of the tasks was I had to write three pieces or three compositions. So that was really my first introduction to composing, or actively composing, I should say. I'm very much, I like to begin either with some kind of improvising kind of fragment, so on my instruments, away from the computer, and then I sort of start to input that. And I kind of work in a bit of a music concrete kind of way. So I don't work in a linear fashion at all, or the timeline of it isn't very linear, although it may end up being quite linear in the end.
What for you is characteristic of a successful or nourishing creative partnership?
I think the most important thing is that you can be yourself artistically and also personally with someone that you want to collaborate with. I think if you find yourself thinking, or being too self-conscious, thinking, what would such and such think, or I couldn't possibly tell them that, you know what, don't think that's a good idea, I think then you're in a little bit of trouble.
There's also a bit of a collaborative relationship that occurs with your teachers.
Oh, so yeah, you've absolutely.
You've had two teachers, or have you had more than that?
Well, I mean, only two for an extended period of time. I mean, I've certainly had composition lessons with people like Matthew Heinzen, and then overseas with Martijn Padding, Richard Ayres, Nico Muley, but only for a period of a week kind of thing.
And what did you find, or what do you find most helpful in a mentor or someone that essentially you're trying to, I guess, you know that you have a compositional technique that you want to know more about,
mm-hmm.
but you need someone to guide you through that terrain. What do you hope to find in a teacher when you're looking for someone like that or reflecting on
Well,
that?
I think first of all, I should say that Bruce was great and still is great. I think, I honestly believe that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for Bruce and his encouragement, especially because I've had him as a mentor since about 2009, since my honours year, and we worked quite closely, or he supervised me quite closely throughout the doctorate. I think the most important thing for me, or certainly in my relationship with him, has been this idea that he's always tried to bring out who I am and really look within the music and look to the material that I'm already working with, which obviously sometimes isn't particularly developed, like at an early stage, and really try and bring out those elements that would make you more you. And try and extend those in some way, or looking at external influences, really looking at what inspires you. So I really think that having Bruce as a mentor wasn't just a musical thing, but also in a wider sort of artistic sense, and also like a personal sense as well, sort of learning to become more mature, those kinds of big scary ideas.
What was your path? So you started at WSU, mm-hmm. you did your
undergrad,
4 years, was it?
Well, 3 years undergrad, then with embedded honours.
Embedded, yeah. Oh, so like that fancy, year. Like, oh, if you want to go to fourth year, you certainly can if you've got the grades.
That's exactly right.
Excellent. And then did you continue at...
Yes, and then, so I've been at WSU for 10 years.
That's fantastic.
So then I did the DCA, so Doctor of Creative Arts in composition. And my supervisors were, as I've already mentioned, Bruce Crossman and also John Incarnasau as well. So John was also a great mentor because he was coming at things from more of a rock music side, or experimental rock, and that side of things really excites me as well. So I think having both of them on board for that was really an integral part for my learning process.
You mentioned before about rock music mm-hmm. being one of your influences.
Certainly.
Yeah, you perform as well.
I do perform.
With Joey.
Not as much as I should. Joey Tabua.
Yeah. He's on electric guitar and...
Mm-hmm. And also electric Gajeng. Sometimes. It just kind of depends on the setting of the gigs. I mean, we don't play as much as I wish that we could. And I should also say he's also from WSU. And he's currently doing the same course that I did, the DCA. also in composition as well. So my collaboration with Joey, it's been great. We've got a great friendship. We've been playing together for about 3 years or so. And I really enjoy the duo format. So playing, obviously, playing drum kit, sometimes other things as well, but mostly drum kit. And he's mostly plays electric guitar, but occasionally with electric guzheng. And we like to create, we kind of have two modes. We sort of have like more of a like club pub mode where we sort of have semi-improvised sets. And then we just kind of go for it and see what happens. And then we kind of have like this other mode, which I feel is slightly weirder, kind of more, I don't know, more experimental, in more a bit more avant-garde kind of, and sometimes with a bit more electronic sounds, things like that.
You were saying before as well, you can approach and you often approach compositions from that place of play. So you mm-hmm. start, you don't sit down and go, oh, problem to solve. I'm a mathematician of music. Here is, I will make this tapestry and there it all works. You said you play and improvise a lot. Have you ever found, you know, playing with Joey that you'll come away from a gig and go, okay, I need to get into my studio and record that later. I think it can be used somewhere, or it solves a problem that I've been looking to solve for a while.
Yeah, sure. Maybe not a gig, but definitely after a rehearsal or a practice session, I think, oh, you know what? I'm totally going to steal some of those licks from Joey's. I'm going to put them in my current
Joey.
Piece.
Yeah. Thanks for that. And then it turns up in his, you know, his doctorate compositions later. You're like, oh, well.
Oh, I mean, more the idea that it's like a something coloristic or a timbre idea. Or the way that maybe the instruments are interacting. Or like a feeling rather than like a straight out melody.
Shoes and ships and sealing wax.
Mm-hmm. Well done. Yep.
I did it. I pronounced it. Great. I wanted to know, you mentioned about taking licks from Joey, like just timbral ideas and things like
that.
Yeah,
sure.
Who did you beg, borrow and steal from with Shoes and Ships and Sealing Wax? Because when I listened to it, I thought, this sounds so much like Luciano Berio's Sinfonia, where he essentially lifts the Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, Symphony number 2, in the third movement, and he also quotes text from, you know, Samuel Beckett's The Unnameable.
Mm-hmm.
So,
First of all, I should say I've never heard that.
You've never heard it?
I've never heard it.
Oh, that's sacrilegious.
No, I've never heard that.
No, it's fantastic. I
feel bad saying I don't even know that that piece exists. So,
no, not at all. I think there's something fantastic about when you've written something and you put it out in the world and someone will come out to you and go, oh, it sounds like this, did you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, we're all connected in some subconscious, crazy way.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly.
No, but I don't know about that particular example at all.
But a lot of your works have references to Lewis Carroll and literature.
Yep, yep.
And I just thought, this is very interesting. There's this soprano and, soprano and ensemble.
Oh, you're thinking of And Where the Pigs Have Wings.
Yes, that's probably the other work. Yep.
But they're connected, though.
They are
so
connected.
So those two, in case you didn't already guess, okay. So I should say that in thinking about this Lewis Carroll sound well that I've been experimenting with, kind of the first in the set that I wrote for... Okay, so there's three pieces that I wrote for the Dutch Ensemble Orchestre Ereprise. So the first one I wrote was Cabbages and Kings, and then the second one was Shoes and Ships and Sealing Wax, and then the third one that I wrote and then was premiered earlier this year is And Where the Pigs Have Wings. So you probably know that stanza in the poem The Walrus and the Carpenter, which comes from Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass, and what Alice found there is... And the stanza goes, I think it goes like this. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot and where the pigs have wings. So I called the final one in that kind of trio. I didn't know it was going to be a trio at that time, but I called the final one And Where the Pigs Had Wings, because I imagined it would probably be the last piece that I would write for the Dutch Ensemble. with pepper and vinegar, pigs with wings.
I listened to some Frank Zappa, Richard Gill, our great staple of the Australian music industry, did a fantastic performance of The Idiot Bastard Son mm-hmm. at the National Music Camp back in January 2014. Have you ever seen any performances that have pushed your limits perceptually or what you think music is? Anything along those lines?
Yeah, I'm kind of tempted to say everything.
Everything is new. Everything is brand new.
I mean, there's not a concert that I don't go to that I don't walk away and I've learnt something new. Whether it's if it's sometimes, you know, to think, oh, okay, don't do that. Like, I think everything really, I think you got to be open to that kind of experience that everything can kind of push what you think is music or what doesn't work. I mean, sometimes some of the best experiences I have in terms of thinking about what is music are things that I see at university and sort of from more of a teaching perspective.
When you say teaching perspective, you mean students handing you work?
Yeah, or? Students handing yeah. me work or me marking student work or performances, that kind of idea. I think there's just so many remarkably creative people out there.
How do you feel about that word in creativity, or that phrase for that matter, of a day job? You need to have a day job to be able to sustain what you're doing creatively. How do you feel about that concept?
Well, I guess at the moment, writing music kind of is my day job, along with teaching as well. I think that I'm, for the time being, pretty lucky to be able to combine both those passions.
Fiddlesticks.
Ah, yes, fiddlesticks. Yep. Yes, so last year I was composing in residence at Prairie Wood High School, which is in Western Sydney, and we had a program that was in tandem with Sydney Youth Orchestras. And so the whole idea was that I would write this piece, which ended up being Fiddlesticks. So that was also like the brand of the project as well as the name of the piece. That would be a piece that I would create for SYO's Sinfonietta string ensemble and also use percussionists from Prairie Wood High School. So over a series of a couple of terms, gotta get that right, terms, not semesters. Over a couple of terms, I went to Prairie Wood and we workshopped a whole lot of different percussion ideas, mainly using improvisation as a starting point. And so because the kind of students that I were working with the exception of maybe one or two, most of them didn't have any kind of musical background at all. So I was using things like junk percussion, so buckets, and I made a whole lot of homemade shakers and sandpaper blocks. That kind of idea. And it was really fun couple of terms going in every week and kind of workshopping these improvised ideas. So I would record them on my Zoom, kind of like the Zoom that we're using here. And then I'd go home and I would listen back to it, maybe transcribe parts that I thought students had come up with that were pretty cool, pretty neat. And then the challenge was to somehow work out how do I use all these ideas from all these kids and put them into a piece which was A, going to work compositionally, be cohesive in some way, but that was also going to be playable in the sense that I was writing to two different skill sets. So Sinfonietta was a higher skill set than, say, the high school students that couldn't read music, so we learnt it all orally. that kind of thing.
That's fantastic. So you had to do a combination of essentially, well, these parts are written for the sinfonietta.
Yeah.
These parts, we've rehearsed these small snippets over and over again, mm-hmm. and this is how it links in as a whole, and this is what you need to listen for and look out for, which is an excellent way to include people in music, because a lot of people, especially young people, are put off, or maybe they slacken off. Certainly when I went into high school, that was the case. A lot of people slackened off from learning learning written music, at least. But certainly when you put an instrument in front of them and they started to play, they showed a sense of like enjoyment and commitment to learning and playing that was just, it was just different, a different way of learning and a different way of playing. One of the participants that was interviewed, there was a short interview that happened with before that piece was performed, and I watched through all of it on YouTube, and it was really lovely to see that a lot of the students mentioned that one of the reasons they were so excited to perform the piece was because it had never been heard before.
Yeah.
So this idea of it being completely new, do you encounter that in your work generally, or?
Oh yeah, look, I mean, maybe this is a stretch, but the first idea that comes to my mind is, oh, it's, I enjoy writing music the most when I surprise myself by the direction that it's gone in. Usually if I have some kind of writing block, it's because I'm too preoccupied with this idea of, oh, okay, this is where I'm taking it, this is where it has to go. And I just find that if I just like loosen up a bit, relax a little, and just sort of let, not my subconscious, that sounds a bit wanky, but just sort of let things happen.
Just let the freedom, let it be free.
On their own, they quite often I discover something that I would never have consciously tried to make happen. And it's those little discoveries and things that's why I really like composing, is I love that feeling that I get from that. Of thinking, oh, okay, oh my goodness, like I just discovered something a little bit new.
I didn't know that
or new for me.
Yeah.
And I really like that kind of idea.
How then would you encourage, it's one thing I think to go to performers with, I mean, I've heard stories before of, you know, ensembles and orchestras doing all types of pranks, hijinks and tricks to conductors / composers for presenting them with music, which they don't think is very, they're like, oh, what is this palaver?
Mm-hmm.
That can often be one of the challenges, but the secondary, or just, I wouldn't say secondary in importance, but secondary in the timeline, is once you've gotten past that, who's going to perform it, who's enthused to perform it and learn it and go on this creative journey, you have the audience. How do you approach that? Do you ever have it in your mind when you've made those discoveries, or I really hope that where this is going to end up at Riverside Theatres or in the Netherlands, that it's going to be received well, or do you just go, well, they'll listen to it and they'll make up their mind and that's not at all within my control, so what can I do about that?
Well, I think a bit of both of those things. I mean, I don't approach it from the point of view that I think, oh, well, it doesn't matter what the audience thinks. I am not necessarily very concerned with what the audience thinks. I mean, ultimately, I want them to enjoy it. And I think that because I'm very interested in bringing in vernacular influences, and whether that's pop music or jazz or rock or prog rock or metal or hip hop or whatever other kind of genre, I'd like to think that those kind of influences in my work make it more accessible. And, well, I hope that they're sort of immediately noticeable. I mean, so for example, a piece I wrote last year, Jabberwock, which was for, I think I mentioned earlier, Sydney Symphony Fellows, when that was first performed at Riverside, also in Parramatta last year, when I first got the brief for that, I knew that it was going to be a family concert, and I also knew that it was going to appear alongside The Sorcerer's Apprentice. So, of course, that informed some of the creative choices that I made, and that also made me think, oh, okay, so if it's a family concert, going to be lots of kids involved, and they're going to be encouraged to dress up as wizards and sorcerers and all this kind of thing. I tried to make it to have some kind of hook that perhaps children could latch onto. So that was why I then decided to have some speaking parts and some kind of some silly chanting parts and things like that, that hopefully that they could get some kind of enjoyment from.
Play that bass just like an ace and strike the strings to make them sing. Turn the drums up in our mix, because this is how we fiddlesticks. Play that beat and keep it neat to feel the groove and move your feet. Turn the strings up in the mix to give us our melodic fix.
I watched as well on YouTube Tweedledrum.
Oh, yes. Yep.
That work in particular, I found, I wanted to ask, is it's a really fascinating conversation between the two players. You said in the notes it was about this idea of a mirror or...
Yeah, I guess... Yeah, yeah it is. I mean, it's mostly about a duel. So I suppose we're all familiar with Tweedledum and Tweedledee. I actually find it really hard to say Tweedledum now because I'm so used to saying Tweedledrum. I find it really hard to get
Tweedledum. So deep drum, yep. Okay.
So, of course, they're characters from a nursery rhyme which appear in Lewis Carroll's work. And, of course, they're twins or they're kind of identical twins. So the whole premise of Tweedledrum is playing with this idea of, yeah, they're a mirror. They're mirroring each other. There's two percussionists. They're facing each other. There's some kind of battle element. It's exploring this idea of a duel and also a duality as well. But also, yes, they're percussion, but they're playing two very different setups of percussion. So one is very much, is a simplified rock kit, pretty much. And then the other one is more of a more from an art music setup where you're playing with families of glass, woods, metals, that kind of idea.
Did you actually decide on what mallets played when? Because when I watched the performance back, I thought that one of the, whether it was your choice or their choice, I thought it was very interesting, this idea of the warped mirror or this duel, because mm-hmm. they each had, in a way, kind of similar things to say to each other.
But yeah, absolutely.
The difference was in the... Often it was as small as the mallets.
Yeah,
just the mallets that they chose. So someone might have soft mallets, someone else might have hard mallets. Just... Did you decide on that or did the performers go, this is where I want it to go?
It's absolutely intended to be like that. I mean, perhaps the part you're thinking of is... There's a few sections where when the percussionist is playing with plastic brushes and there's also sticks being played on a cowbell or hard rubber mallets being sounded. And, of course, they're playing similar kind of figures, but as you could imagine and as you've probably seen from this video, those similar kind of figures, when voiced on a mallet made of different material, has a very different sonority to it.
I have two more questions left for you. What outside of music most inspires you and or your work?
Oh, well, this one's a no-brainer. I would say literature. I mean, pretty much Lewis Carroll. So I think the reason that I feel like I came late to the Lewis Carroll game, and it wasn't really until I was about 20, 21 that I read the Alice books. I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that, but I think that the great thing about the books is that although they're written for a younger audience, at the same time, they're absolutely not. Like, I think that they're just so witty and so clever. And I just find the characters wonderful. So yeah, definitely literature.
Why do you compose?
Why? Oh. First thing that comes to mind is because it's something I have to do. But I don't know if that's true. I think, for me right now, it's the... best way for me to express myself. I mean, I love playing in bands and I find that a very collaborative process. And I love collaborating with Joey. But I also sometimes feel as though I want to express something that's only me as well. Whether such a thing is possible, I don't know. But that's certainly something that I aim to do. I feel like I can express myself better musically than I can in words, whether written or spoken, or that I can performing, whether that's music that I've written with other people or not.
Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all of the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, Project Patron Cameron Lamb of Kamaklang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's Match Funding Program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Pelias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Marlena Radice and Mark Wolf. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Ellie Simic-Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support, either by subscribing to this podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support for more.